It's quite touching, really, because the Manchester Buddhist Centre was my first contact with Tree Ratna back in 1992. It wasn't this building in those days. It was, I'm trying to remember where it was. Was it Welly Range or somewhere like that? Chorlton, yeah. Very different place. And I was, I wasn't here for very long, but I do remember doing a course, a Dharma course, with someone with a funny name that began with Rat, who was of course it took me several years to discover. Oh right, that was Rat Laguna, wasn't it? And my very first sevenfold puja was Rat Laguna's handing on of the chair to Artur Priya. So I have warm memories of being in Manchester, and there's something quite poignant about coming back in the role of giving a talk, having first met the Dharma here. I also remember this building being bought and the renovations being undergone. I had various friends doing the work here. Was anyone here involved in that? Yeah, some of you were. Heroic work indeed. Yeah. And you probably know that, in a way, the template for large Buddhist centre renovations was the London Buddhist Centre in Bethnal Green, which was, I think, bought in about 1974 by this wonderfully idealistic and naive bunch of people who decided they could renovate it in 6 months or something. And it took them 4 years, and you probably know the story. So they were working incredibly, incredibly hard. They were living on site in this derelict building, this burnt out fire station in Bethnal Green. Pretty rough conditions for a lot of the period of time they were there. Working very hard, guided by Subhuti. You probably know of Subhuti. So they were working very hard and they were practicing very hard. And I suspect they were playing pretty hard as well. And it was during this period that Bhante delivered a seminar at Padmaloka in Norfolk. And I think most, if not all, of the people on the Sukhavati project, the London Buddhist Centre build project, I think they were all pretty much all on this seminar. And the ways of Bhante's workings are always a bit mysterious, but I think we can be pretty confident that what he chooses to say and deliver, he thinks is pertinent to the time. And the seminar he decided to do with this bunch of guys, it was all guys doing this project, was a seminar on a perfection of wisdom text called the Rat Laguna Samuchayagata. And the introduction, or at least part of this material that he delivered, was this teaching or perspective that we're calling the greater mandala of uselessness. And I think there's no coincidence here. We've got this bunch of guys who are completely focused on this task, working very, very hard. And my experience of being in those kinds of situations is one can get a bit kind of overly focused on the work. You probably know what it's like. You can start to get into the state where, especially with young guys working together, can get a bit competitive. Who's working the hardest? Who's having the longer tea breaks? Who's reading a bit too long? Who's whatever it is, you know, one can get a bit over-focused on the work. Justifying ourselves by working very hard, feeling good about ourselves because we're working hard, or feeling bad ourselves because we're not quite up to the mark, or whatever it is. And so Bhante delivers this seminar in which he talks about the greater mandala of uselessness in 1976. You can read about it in this book, Wisdom Beyond Words, if you've not come across it. I commend it to you. It's a collection of, I think, three different seminars on three different texts. You've got the Heart Sutra in here, the Diamond Sutra, and the Rat Laguna Samuchayagata. So if you want to know what Bhante's got to say about the Heart Sutra especially, this is your text, the Wisdom Beyond Words. So what is the greater mandala of uselessness? I'll start on a slightly different tack on what I think it's trying to address, which I think we might call the Protestant work ethic. I was just reading a bit about the Protestant work ethic, because I don't really know very much about it. It's just one of these words that seems to float around, and it describes Northern European attitudes to work. And I'll try and explain what little I understand of the theology of it, because I think it's quite interesting. Even if I get the theology completely wrong, which I'm sure some of you can correct me, there's a kind of interesting principle here. So as I understand it, the theology goes in Protestantism, I think this comes from Luther, that a little bit like Bhante talks of the Buddha being outside of time, that certain people are already predestined to salvation. These are the elect. You might have heard of the elect. So kind of out of time, it's already decided who is already predestined to be for salvation. And so, of course, we want to know, are we one? Are we one of the elect? So you can kind of have a look at your life to discover this. Now, another aspect of Protestantism is a valuation of work as a duty to society. So secular work has got this value that it's a duty to society. And so you can tell if you're one of the elect, because God will be smiling on you. You'll experience his grace in your work. So if you're successful in your work, then you're one of the elect. And so this leads, obviously, to us wanting to make a success of ourselves in our work, in our secular work, to kind of prove to ourselves that we are one of the elect. Now, the reason, however skew with my theology, is what I find interesting is that you get this very manifest behaviour and set of values that comes out of quite an abstruse bit of theology, quite an abstruse view, if you like. So for me, this is one reminder of the importance of view. You know, the views that we hold, the perspectives that we hold, they, whether we know it or not, they filter through into our actions. So I'm sure people here aren't holding the view that you are predestined and da-da-da-da-da. And yet this culture of the so-called Protestant work ethic is deeply embedded in our culture, in our society. And it is basically the motor for capitalist society. It's why Northern European Protestant countries are generally bigger financial motors than Southern European Catholic cultures, which don't have that same theology, which is interesting. And yes, you can see just how important it is to run this kind of capitalist society. My partner has got a brother who lives on the Pacific island of Vanuatu. He runs this big kitchen in a swanky hotel. I think he's got 50 people working under him. And of course he employs the locals. And the locals do not have the Protestant work ethic. It's rather difficult to manage them, because they'll quite happily disappear for days on end. And then they'll come back and they'll say, "Why didn't you come into work the last few days?" And they'll say, "I didn't need the money, I went fishing." And it's rather difficult to run a business that way. So, the Greater Mandala of Uselessness. It's not really doctrine, it's not really theology, it's not really view, but it's, I think you can call it a perspective. So, a mandala, I can't go into what a mandala is in its fullness, but let's say it is a description of any collection of things into something whole. So we can look at the mandala of our life, for example. The mandala of our life is the total arrangement of all the facets of our life, everything we do, everything we think, whatever, all the components of our life. And for many of us, not for everyone, but for many of us, the mandala of our life is composed of lots of activities, lots of useful activities, which is a marvellous thing. It is marvellous to be productive, to be active, to contribute to society, contribute to other people's welfare. That's all fantastic stuff. The danger is, and what I think this teaching is trying to counteract, is how we value ourself, how we value our sort of basic essence in terms of our activity. If we value ourself solely on the basis of how much work we're getting done, how many boxes we're ticking on our to-do list, then things start getting a bit skew-whiff. If nothing else, everything can fall apart when we retire or when we lose the capability to be a valuable, productive member of society and financial means and so on. So what I'm interested in talking about this evening is this area of how we value ourselves and how that then influences our attitude to activity and inactivity. So let's start off with a quote from Sangharakshita. This is in a way the fundamental laying out of the shop. He says, "You don't have to justify your existence by being useful. You yourself are the justification for your existence. You haven't come into existence after all these millions of years of evolution just to sit down in front of a typewriter or computer or to keep accounts. You are the justification of that whole process. You are an end in yourself. All that you can really be said to be here for is to develop into some higher form of human life, to become a bodhisattva, to become a Buddha. So don't be ashamed of sitting around and doing nothing. Glory in it. Do things spontaneously, out of a state of inner satisfaction and achievement. It is a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful." So you can't call that doctrine in a way, but it's a view. It's a view that we can bring sort of consciously into our being and see what effect it has on us. It may not even affect our outward manifestation very much, but it may affect how we feel about how we manifest. But anyway, I'd like to, through the talk, just explore how that might influence our being and doing. So one aspect of this, of what he's talking about here, is a non-utilitarian attitude to life. Non-utilitarian attitude to each other. Isn't it all too easy? I find it all too easy to, especially when I've got a kind of something to do, I've got something important, it's important to do, and people will, are relying on me. And so I need other people to get this done, and so they become an object for me to relate to in order to subtly or not so subtly manipulate them to do what I want them to do. So we can start out of the best of motives, initially at least, to relate to other people as in utilitarian modes. Or even if it's just going to the supermarket and buying our groceries, do we relate to the person behind the till as the person who is serving me, serving my need? Or can we see them in a completely non-utilitarian manner? Can we see them as, they are the justification for their existence? It's a different kind of lens, a different kind of way of looking out at the world. So there's a man called Maitreya Bandhu who gave a talk on exactly this subject at Cambridge fairly recently, and I listened to it. I thought I'd do my homework. And almost the first thing he said was, "We don't need this anymore. This is the wrong time for this teaching. This teaching was appropriate to its time." So I wasn't expecting that. And the reasons he gave were that there is so much that needs to happen in the world There's so much that we can contribute to the world, you know, with our access to the Dharma. And there's a tendency towards kind of individualistic, kind of inward orientation in our practice. Sort of, and I don't disagree with him there. I've just been on the Indian, I've just been to India for the Order Convention. And the attitude within the Indian Order is completely outward looking. They see themselves as taking part in the Dharma revolution, the Dharma Kranti they call it. They feel themselves to be revolutionaries. They are changing society. They have a burning desire to take the Dharma out and to change the culture that they live in. And that is completely marvellous. So I really don't want the greater mandala of uselessness to turn our energies inwards and into a sort of passivity. And at the same time, if we're going to change the world, it doesn't help anyone to come at it from a place of harassment and harriedness and anger and impatience and relating to the people in our way as opposition and foolish and people to get out of the way. It requires an attitude of, I think this greater mandala, this attitude of this sort of greater context, we can call it a greater context, a greater attitude that is spacious enough to hold contradiction in a way, to hold all the contradictions that we come up against when we try to get into changing the world, changing any situation, changing the smallest situation is a huge task. And we need a lot of patience with other people. We need a lot of perspective. Coming at any problem, any entrenched problem with a narrow vision, this is how it's going to turn out, probably isn't going to work. I remember hearing a teaching which I took to heart. In any situation, in any dialogue, in any negotiation, the person with the most alternatives, the most alternative possibilities, with the most flexibility, they're the ones who win. The person with the least flexibility, it's too brittle, they always end up losing. Anyway, so this is one of my justifications for still thinking this is very important. I will just quote someone against me. I'll quote Hawkwind. Hawkwind is, was 18th century Zen practitioner from the, what I think of as the boot camp school of Zen Buddhism. Hawkwind, for example, one stage, Hawkwind and a friend of his, they sat in this broom cupboard, basically, meditating for 1 week solid, opposite each other, one stick away from each other. They each had a stick in order to hit the other one with in case they started falling asleep during this week. And neither of them needed to use the stick. Anyway, this is Hawkwind for you. And he wrote this text called The Life of Activity Compared to the Life of Calm. I'll come back to this again later, but he's very concerned about people getting overly passive. He said, one who's carrying on the life of calm will sooner or later find they are unable to enter into the active life at all. If someone who's been leading the life of calm has to enter the active life with its worldly business, they may find they entirely lose all the advantages of the powers which they attained in their quiet place of meditation. And I can relate to this as well, actually, because as Artavardhan said, I spent 2 years on retreat. I spent 2 years on retreat in Spain. And coming off those retreats, I did find myself getting quite kind of overwhelmed by activity, by the demands of life. So I'm trying to hold these two things together, and what he's calling the life of activity and the life of calm. We'll come back to the Hakarin. My personal reason for giving this talk, because I'm giving this talk to myself, really. Thanks for coming. I don't think I'm quite a workaholic. I don't think. Luckily, there's no one in the room who can tell me I'm wrong. But I do enjoy work, and I can get quite invested with work. So by that I mean I get a bit narrowed down and a bit identified with being productive. And that leads to this kind of brittleness. And it leads to a kind of momentum, a sort of working momentum, which at the end of the day feels a bit kind of ropey. I don't feel in great shape at the end of the day because I've had this sort of driving momentum. It's not always the case. I can sometimes get very absorbed in work, and I remember a time, probably the busiest time of my life actually, it's when I was in Cambridge and we were moving the centre from the old centre to what's now the new centre. Anyway. And I was doing it more or less on my own, and I was as full as I've ever been in my life. And what I discovered then is when I stopped to stop, when I just sat down, and when I meditated, I was completely present and I had this really good, clean energy. And then I could start again. So I've got a sense of what it can be like to get really absorbed in work and then put it down and stop and to be very content with clean energy. Too much of the time what I feel is the energy I've been working with is a bit too grasping, it's a bit too invested in the outcome. There's too much of a background state of I've got to get this done or dot dot dot. And actually the dot 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 is not very consequential half the time, but you know, there's just this sense of identification, I've got to get this done, got to get this done. Okay, so this is why I think it's still important. I don't think I'm the only one actually. So I've talked about, if you like, the view of the greater mandala of uselessness, the perspective that we can bring. And I believe that these views, they can influence our being at quite a deep level. But I'll talk also about, if you like, the practice, because I think we can do some very practical things here. So Hakarin talked about it as the life of activity and the life of calm. We could call it even more simply doing and being as a basic polarity in life. Two extremes, if you like. I'll read to you what Sangharakshita has got to say about this. So he's talking about two extremes, these two extremes of being and doing, so the unhealthy extremes of being and doing. He says, on the one hand, we can be so immersed in practical activities that we identify with them and consequently become rather harassed and worried, losing sight of the wider horizons of aesthetic appreciation. I'll come back to this aesthetic appreciation. On the other hand, we can lose ourselves in a spaced out, if vaguely positive, state of mind in which we are unable to get anything done. The ideal is the middle way. We need to carry on the cycle of practical activities to which we are not attached, which does not harass us, about which we don't worry, within the much wider circle of the greater mandala. Then we can enjoy our work because it is interpenetrated by this appreciative awareness. This kind of balance is not at all easy to achieve. All the time we're likely to be tending towards one or the other of these two extremes, so that we'll need to make constant adjustments to keep a middle way. So this middle way, I think of it as a dynamic I mean, in fact, he hints that it's likely to be a dynamic middle way. It's not trying to find a state where we're sort of not too busy and not too quiet. It's more like when we're active, we're really absorbed and we're really intent, and we're doing in an integrated way as far as possible. We've got our energies engaged in doing. And when we're being, we put it down. We really just put it down, and we enjoy the state of not doing. And I think there's a kind of interweaving that can go on here at all different scales. So one of my projects for myself at the moment is, while I'm doing, got my working day, between tasks, you know, sending an email, you know, maybe I've got to write an email. So I write the email, and then I just put it down for just 20 seconds. Just have a 20 second break. You can do this right now. Just for 20 seconds, just sort of let the mind fall open. It's not very long, I'm not counting, but maybe it's even less than 20 seconds. Just that sort of length of time. And then on to the next thing. So that's the sort of smallest scale, if you like. And then, you know, you have your daily meditation practice. And then maybe every few months you go off on the weekend retreat. And then maybe once or twice a year you go off on the longer retreat. And in my case, well, after 15 years of working in the Buddhist Centre, I went off for 2 years retreat. And that felt important. I'd been doing a lot of going out, and then I wanted to have some definite time of being up there in the mountains and retreat. So I think this is something we can do in our life, is just make sure we have this kind of alternation of being and doing and being and doing at different scales. And I find this very difficult. Because of course, if we're not careful, being is what happens when you come to the end of the to-do list, isn't it? Okay, I've come to the end of the to-do list, therefore I can be, I can stop now. It's a bit of a hypothetical state, this, isn't it? The end of the to-do list. It never actually comes. At least it isn't for me, I don't know about you. So the only way to get being in your life is you put it on the to-do list, either literally or metaphorically. It has to be something you consciously make time for. I'm sure Ratnaguna has told you this story. Ratnaguna is an exemplar of this. He schedules time for being, and I'm sure he's told you this story where his friend phones him up and says, "What are you doing on such and such a day?" And Ratnaguna says, "I'm doing nothing." He says, "I want to meet up." "No, I'm doing nothing. It's in my diary. I'm doing nothing." So this is something we can quite literally do. We can schedule doing nothing. And it's, oh gosh, isn't it hard? Even just sitting there with a cup of tea and doing nothing. It's like smartphones. Aren't smartphones the death of doing nothing? And it's so easy for my hand just to go to the smartphone, you know, while I'm having my cup of tea, and what's on the news, and who's done what on Facebook, and yeah, back in the pocket. I know. So I very frequently commend a practice, a doing nothing practice, to people. And I've worked up certain rules now. I've got rules for doing nothing practice. So in Vajrapraya, doing nothing practice, you are allowed to look out of the window. So you're allowed to look at nature, but you're not allowed to look at your smartphone or paper or book or anything like that. You can look out the window or look at a fire or something. You're allowed a cup of tea or other hot beverage of your choice. That's the only accessory you're allowed. And then you just do that for whatever, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And there isn't really any other rule. It's nice to bring an attitude of being present to it without trying to make a project out of that. Just let yourself be bored or whatever happens. That's the job, just do nothing. I was telling you, and Artavadra was telling you about these couple of year-long retreats. On the first one I did, I did quite a bit of doing nothing. I used to spend the evening before the puja just sitting in a chair and looking at our fire, if we had the fire on, and drinking a cup of tea. But there was someone else on the retreat who was a complete master. I have no more words for him, really. So he would sit there with his cup of Darjeeling tea, very fine Darjeeling tea, brought it with him, and he'd have this chair under the shade and this view across the mountains, and he'd be sat there, and I'd walk past him to go into the shrine room, and I'd go and do my very virtuous double sit, and then I'd walk out and he'd still be there, and I'd go and do my yoga, and then I'd walk back to get my lunch and he'd still be sat there, and then I'd finish my lunch and he'd still be sat there, and he'd spend hours and hours in his chair with his cup of tea, getting very increasingly cold, I should think. Literally for hours on end. I found it extraordinary. Okay, so it's the simplest practice that you can possibly do, really. But doing it is what's hard. Doing the being is what's difficult. You're probably aware that there's a sort of an outer being and there's an inner level of being. So just sitting there with your cup of tea, not doing anything, is a great start. And then there's a question of what's going on inside. For the mind to settle into a state of just being, that's a different demand again, really. And it's very easy to bring a state of, or an attitude of doing, to being. To your meditation practice, for example, does your meditation practice feel like a chore? Does it feel like something you've got to do so that you remain a good Buddhist? Does it feel like something you've got to do so that at the end of the day you can feel, well, at least I did my meditation practice, or however often you do it? Is there, in other words, what I'm saying is there some level of justifying our being through meditation practice, our Dhamma practice? Are we justifying our existence by doing the right thing? I know this is certainly what I've been working with for quite a few years now, is just noticing the slight level of anxiety that comes in meditation if it's not going well. So why should I be anxious? Why should I be worried if I'm getting very distracted? It's because it's threatening my self-justification. If I'm not all right, if I'm measuring my all rightness by how the meditation is going, then that's going to be a fraught situation at some subtle level. So yes, there's the possibility of bringing this kind of doing mode into our being. And then the question comes, can we bring being into doing? This is maybe even more demanding. Can we, into the midst of our activity, can we bring a sense of calm being, not needing to justify our existence? And as Sangharakshita puts it, how did he put it? Do things out of a state of inner satisfaction and achievement. So we do it through sheer satisfaction, through sheer sense of wanting to contribute, rather than anything more brittle that's to do with needing to shore up my sense of myself and feel like I'm justifying my existence. This is leading in the direction of the Bodhisattva's work, because you probably know the Bodhisattva, the person who is working for the benefit of all beings, of helping to awaken all beings. They've got a hell of a job on their hands. They've vowed to liberate all beings. That's, you know, liberating myself is quite hard enough, but never mind one other person, never mind all other beings. So how on earth can the Bodhisattva approach that kind of task without getting supremely harassed at the impossibility of their task? They've got to bring an attitude of being into that task. And I think there's a sort of a quality here that we can touch on ourselves, which is the quality of play. The Bodhisattva has a quality of play, of lila. And we can bring a quality of play into our own life. Spontaneity, as Sangharakshita calls it, non-utilitarian activity. I was just telling Artavadin I'm going on a week-long dancing retreat on Friday, which I'm extremely excited about. It's a rare moment of really non-utilitarian. Well, actually, it's probably very enjoyable, but anyway. So, I think the quality of lila, of play, is one sort of hint that we might get as to how to bring being into doing. I've got a friend who's very good at bringing play into our work. We work together, but he's just good at making things into a game, and it really lightens things up. But it also makes things more spacious. It's like you can relax a little bit. So that's a little bit about the practice. So I've talked about the greater mandala as a view, and there's some ideas on practice. And then in terms of fruit, the fruit of the greater mandala of uselessness. So when Bhante started talking about the greater mandala, what he actually talked about it as the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, and he mentioned aesthetic appreciation in his quotes a little bit. So what on earth has uselessness and aesthetic appreciation got in common? So in fact, the word that Bhante is using, or the word he's translating as aesthetic appreciation, is the Sanskrit word vidya, or Pali vidya. And you may have come across this, you might know it better with its opposite. Its opposite is avidya, or avidya, which means delusion or ignorance. This is the word that's most commonly used to describe ignorance on, for example, the outside of the Wheel of Life, one of the three poisons in the centre of the Wheel of Life. So vidya is the opposite of ignorance. So it's often loosely rendered as wisdom. But what has aesthetic appreciation got to do with wisdom? I think this is really interesting, because it's a clue, it's quite a kind of tangible clue, feeling our way into this quality of vidya. So vidya, the opposite of ignorance, it's an awakened perception, an awakened mode of perceiving the world around us. And it's awakened because it's not clouded by ignorance, and that means that it's not caught up in craving and aversion. And I think this is a bit difficult to imagine, because normally our experience of the world is tinged almost invisibly by craving and aversion. We either, to a large extent, we want something out of some sense experience, or we don't want that sense experience, or we're not too fussed about it, in which case we sort of ignore it, tune it out. So vidya is perception without that kind of deluded relating to the perception. And the best way I've heard it talked about is Bhante again, actually. He talks about it as relishing. He says vidya is a sort of relishing of things, a harmony with the world. Its opposite, avidya, conveys a sense of alienation and conflict. So can we just feel into the possibility of relishing sense contact without having to either want to own it, want to hold on to it, or wanting to push it away? And in fact, it wasn't Bhante who translated this as aesthetic appreciation, it's Herbert Gunther. But yes, aesthetic appreciation is one way of rendering that sort of relationship. It's maybe a more tangible way, more accessible way of talking about avidya. It's the state of perceiving the world around us without this dualistic tension. And so, if you're inhabiting that kind of mode of being, you're moving towards the wisdoms, or you're experiencing the wisdoms, both of Amitabha and Ratnasambhava. So Amitabha's wisdom is that of experiencing the uniqueness of all things, all people, all sense contact. It's all exquisitely unique. What I'm interested in is Ratnasambhava's wisdom, Savatanyana, the wisdom of sameness, where you experience the sameness of all experience, and all experience is the same. In what way? It's the same because you've got the same six senses doing their thing. The six senses showing forth sight contact, sound contact. In a sense, it's all of the same essence. It's all the essence of experience, if you like. And the reason I'm talking about this is because I think it starts to make sense of how Hukrin finished off his talk. So remember, Hukrin was saying how where he's talking about the difference between the life of activity and the life of calm. And he finishes off saying, "But you must not think that all I've said means you should dislike or cease from trying to carry on the discipline of the life of calm and deliberately seek out to only live the life of activity. The less one understands and knows about these two conditions of life, the active and the calm, the more careful one should be to value them both and remember that they are only two aspects of one uniform condition." Two aspects of one uniform condition. And I think this is the fruit of this kind of movement, where we can move from activity to calm, activity to calm, without experiencing them as two completely different aspects of life. And I think that's probably where the Bodhisattva's heading. So that is what I take to be the fruit of this kind of practice. But I just want to leave you again with the view, with Bhante's quote on the view of the greater mandala of uselessness. And then we can see if there's any questions. "You don't have to justify your existence by being useful. You yourself are the justification for your existence. You haven't come into existence after all these millions of years of evolution just to sit down in front of a typewriter or to keep accounts. You are the justification of that whole process. You are an end in yourself. All that you can really be said to be here for is to develop into some higher form of human life, to become a bodhisattva, to become a Buddha. So don't be ashamed of sitting around and doing nothing. Glory in it. Do things spontaneously, out of a state of inner satisfaction and achievement. It is a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful." Okay.
So Bhadra Priya is happy to take questions. I think when we've done previously, I think what's been useful is if we just have 5 minutes, maybe just to talk with our neighbours and just explore what we've heard and see if there's any questions we want to ask, and we'll come back together in 5 minutes.
Great.
See if there's see if there's something there. So if you just want to call the people around you, if there's anyone who wants to model.
Sure thing.
So interesting.
Power bank.
What?
Is it a power bank?